welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we spend the hour talking about activism, media freedom. We'll talk about artists and creativity. We'll also be showcasing the work of Project Censored. We'll be joined first by Eleanor Goldfield of Act Out. She'll be talking about her work and activism, as well as her website, artkillingapathy.com. Later in the show, we're joined by Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We'll talk about our latest book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll be spending the hour talking about issues of media freedom, and of course, we'll be talking about politics, activism, and current events. Our first guest is returning to the program. She is Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist, journalist, and poet. She's the founder and host of the creative and grassroots show Act Out, which airs on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, Roku, Amazon Fire, and others. Her spoken word performances blend visual projections and politically charged poetry. A book of her poems and activist artist's work is published in 2017 via Styx Forlag in Sweden. It's called Paradigm Lost. Eleanor Goldfield is currently based in Washington, D.C. You can learn more at artkillingapathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Mickey.
Eleanor, it's definitely a pleasure to have you on because your activism is quite prolific. We had you on not long ago with our good friend Michael Levitin talking about your work and your publication. And today we wanted to dive a little bit more into your activism and the things that you've been up to more recently, and that list is long. Could you please just tell listeners a little bit more about your background and how you got into activism?
Sure. The short version of that story is I started as an environmentalist, just picking up trash around my neighborhood, and then I went on to do things like a recycling program at school. Around the second Iraq War in 2002-2003, when I was in high school, I started organizing and participating in anti-war protests in North Carolina. We all know how that turned out. I then started to dig a little bit deeper and found that all of these issues, whether that be environmentalism, racial injustice, environmental injustices, are all connected. So I became sort of a nomad when it came to activism. I went to whichever fight needed me and whichever fight I felt that I could be the most useful at, and that continues to this day. Of course, with the addition of my work as a journalist, which really ramped up around Occupy. My show Act Out is via Occupy.com and is, as you mentioned, is syndicated via Free Speech TV. So basically, at this point, I do activism on a lot of different fronts, both as a journalist to cover the stories that corporate media will never touch, as well as highlighting the efforts of these creative activists, because I think a lot of people don't realize that the issue that they feel is most important is already being worked on by other people that they could connect with and they could get ideas from. So I try to highlight the incredible work being done across the country, but also across the world by really powerful visionaries and activists. And I also try to help organizing when I can and when it's useful.
It's a very inspiring story. That's why I wanted you to at least tell us the brief version. Many of us here at Project Censored are in academia, at least with one foot, and another foot in civic engagement and activism with the other. Not only is it a privilege to be around a lot of young people and people eager to learn, but it's great, again, to introduce so many young people in our classes to all of the great work that people like you are doing and others. And so I think it's really important that everyday people just hear those stories and hear how people get involved and what people can do to make the world different. Obviously, we hope we make it a better, more inclusive, more egalitarian world. But again, these stories, I think, are quite important. And the merging of activism and creativity, that seems to be a nexus for you. Could you talk a little bit about the creative element of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I typically do in talks that I give, as I quote James Baldwin, who spoke about the power of art and activism and how artists are really the ones that not only have a responsibility to show us the truth of our world and how to survive it, but they have that responsibility. And one of my favorite lines of his is that poets, and by that he means all artists, are the only people who know the truth about us. Soldiers don't, statesmen don't, priests don't, union leaders don't, only poets. And I love that line because it really speaks to that idea that artists have a responsibility to speak and speak truth, but to speak and speak what it means to be a human being as well. And to quote another person, Bertolt Brecht said, the artist is not just holding a mirror up to society, the artist is a hammer to shape it. And I think that movements run on emotion. Movements run on hope. They also, of course, run on knowledge and the search for truth. And artists are a tremendous tool in this fight. And artists do have a responsibility to do that, not only for movements, but also just for the overwhelming majority of citizens who might not feel connected to a movement or know that they could be connected. Art is a very powerful way of connecting people on an emotional level before your sort of biases and your preconceived notions have a chance to step in and tell you you shouldn't be moved by this piece. And just that word, being moved by it, is something that art can do but no spreadsheet can do. So I really feel that art, in that sense, has a tremendous role, and from everything from moving people to act to soothing people when the fight gets hard. And also in terms of creative actions, I don't just think of that as art. You know, even just planting a garden in an urban area is a creative action because you're thinking outside the confines of the capitalist norm and what you're, quote-unquote, supposed to be doing with that space. So creative activism to me is everything that falls into that concept of thinking outside the confines of what the system has programmed you or expects you to do.
Indeed, Eleanor Goldfield, and my actual door into activism as an early teen was through music, and I still write and play, but I was a musician professionally for a long time and composer, and for me, that was just such a great, powerful outlet, and it merged so many important ideas, and I guess I'm on another side of that now. Instead of writing songs and touring and gigging, I'm doing books and talking on the radio, but it's all cut from the same cloth, and I really like how you tied all that together. And by the way, since you quoted James Baldwin, this is a nice segue, I think, for us, is Baldwin also said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And some of the important work that you uncover are these stories that the corporate media won't cover. And certainly the perspectives that you often give in your work are perspectives that one rarely, if ever, hears in the corporate news media. So it's very difficult for the public often to face things about which they're wholly unfamiliar. So could you talk to us a little bit more about a couple things that you've been working on a lot lately? I know and I suspect net neutrality is surely one of them.
Yes, it is. But before I get to net neutrality, because net neutrality, even though Truth Out, I believe, just recently released a report that said 2 weeks after the FCC announced that their decision that on December 14th they'd be holding the vote to basically kill net neutrality, corporate media covered the concept or the words net neutrality for less than 2 minutes, all of the corporate media outlets combined. So yeah, of course, but even less covered than net neutrality, if you can believe it, the issues of pipelines, and it's something that I've been covering pretty much extensively. And something that's interesting that people don't hear about is, for example, between 2015 and 2017, we've averaged a large-scale oil spill more than once a day in the United States. That's crude oil and hazardous materials pipelines. That's not including natural gas pipelines. If you consider natural gas pipelines, the federal data between 2010 and 2017 leaked a total of 17.55 billion cubic feet of mostly methane gas. And methane gas has at least 30 times the warming potential of carbon dioxide. And those pipeline incidents took nearly 100 lives, injured close to 500 people, and forced the evacuation of thousands, and cost over $1 billion in terms of damages. That's pipelines that are perpetually leaking. This is not just sort of, oh, we heard that there was a leak in North Dakota. Oh, that must be unusual. It's not. It happens more than once a day. And these are federal numbers, too. These reports were done using federal data. So this doesn't include small-scale spills or spills that aren't reported, which unfortunately is a lot of spills. There's a threshold at which an oil company has to report a spill. Under that threshold, they're not actually mandated to report the spill. And unfortunately, even when they go above that, oftentimes they don't, because it's kind of a pain to have to admit that your pipeline spilled. So a lot of these incidents aren't even reported. So it's actually an underestimation to say that on average, we have a crude oil or hazardous material pipeline that spills more than once a day. That's even an underestimation. And of course, the most disgusting fact of all of this is that it's completely unnecessary. You know, on December 5th, a father and son were killed because they were using a tractor on their field in Illinois, in Lee County, and they hit a pipeline. They hit a natural gas pipeline, and they exploded. And Kinder Morgan, the company, their only response was, well, they should have called us to see about the exact location of the pipeline. The only problem is that having spoken to people, in particularly in Pennsylvania, which is one of the states where natural gas pipelines crisscross almost every mile, I've talked to people who live there, and they say, well, the companies come to us and tell us it's so safe. You know, everything's going to be, you're not even going to know it's there. You just continue with your day-to-day life. Everything's going to be fine. Well, that's exactly what this father and son were doing. They were going about their daily lives. And furthermore, how can you tread softly with a tractor on a field? This is daily farm work that these people are doing, and there's no way to avoid using this heavy machinery as part of their work. And yet, now we know that, of course, if you do that, you run the risk of exploding. Another natural gas pipeline exploded on December 6th. And although no one was injured, the company reported that they have no idea why it just exploded and sent flames hundreds of feet into the air. They don't know, and of course, at the end of the day, they don't really care either because they can just pass that up and move on, particularly because no one was hurt. They won't have to pay anything. It's very convenient for them to just cover this up and ignore it. And meanwhile, we're told that we need this for our energy consumption. If you imagine what would happen if 100 people over the course of less than a decade died from solar panels, the amount of outrage. And yet, because it's pipelines and because there's so much political importance behind fossil fuels, we're just told that this is a necessary evil behind energy consumption.
Eleanor Goldfield, that's just an amazing and a catastrophic listing of information that, again, is not on corporate media. It's not part of any national dialogue whatsoever. That's sad and incredible at the same time. And you mentioned that these two unfortunate folks that were doing daily farm work, the response from the company was, they should have called us?
Yeah, their response was, I don't have the exact response in front of me, but the response was something to the effect that there's a hotline. There's a sign that says, before you dig, call this hotline. And so they said, well, they should have called. But the problem is that using a tractor does not really constitute heavy digging. That's using a tractor. So their response was, oh, well, they should have called us. That doesn't even apply to the realities of the situation, which was them using a tractor on their farm field, which is what you do when you farm.
The lack of accountability and the degree of callousness in that story is again, sad and astounding. I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with activist and journalist Eleanor Goldfield. You can learn more about Eleanor's work at artkillingapathy.com. We were just talking about the merging of activism and arts and creativity, as well as journalism. And in this last segment here, we were wrapping up talking about a seriously underreported pattern of news stories about oil pipeline leaks. And for some folks in the United States, oil pipelines cross the radar with the XL pipeline or Dakota Access Pipeline. We just heard from Eleanor Goldfield about how there are more than one a day. There's more, on average, more than one spill a day. So just do the math here about how much environmental degradation, loss of life, long-term damage of this because of our addiction to fossil fuels. Largely, again, because the petrochemical industry is so huge, the amount of money that pours in from that sector to the political establishment, to the corporate news media, that basically seems to ensure that these kinds of things will continue to happen, and corporate media will likely continue to ignore or downplay these while also ignoring alternatives for renewable energy. Eleanor Goldfield, maybe pick up from there about the issue of renewables and renewable energy.
Sure. I mean, as you mentioned, one of the things that I typically tell people on my show is follow the money. And there are sites such as Open Secrets where you can very easily find who's making money off of the destruction of people and planet for profit. In terms of renewable energy sources, this is not just a matter of planet and people. It's also a matter of profit. You even see big corporations going more towards renewables because oil and gas are becoming less and less viable economically. The reason that we have so many calls for natural gas export facilities is because natural gas is not economically feasible locally, which is even a more sick and twisted aspect of the natural gas pipeline industry, is that we are cutting through people's homes and livelihoods and their lives to export these natural gases to other places so that people in other places will have an economic boost, will have jobs and things like that. There's absolutely no profit for the people whose lives are destroyed by these pipelines. With regards to renewable energy, you know, we lag severely behind the rest of the world, particularly behind the industrialized world. But even countries like Germany, for example, that have become sort of a bastion of renewable energy, they still get 40% of their energy from coal, 23% of which comes from lignite coal, which is the dirtiest form of coal. So really, the corporate stranglehold on fossil fuels and the corporate stranglehold on policy because of that is considerable around the world. And the only way that we can possibly break that is to not only to push this story of the economic feasibility of renewables compared, of course, to the fossil fuel industry, but also, as I point out in my show very frequently, is to join these movements that are happening around the country, but also around the world with regards to pushing alternative fuel sources. And something that I've seen frequently are smaller co-ops and smaller community efforts to push renewable energy sources. Currently in DC, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network is pushing for a carbon tax so as to get companies and politicians to see the point of renewable energy sources, particularly if there's an even larger economic press on fossil fuels. But a lot of it is local politics in that same vein. And I think it's really important that people look at what they can do on a local level, because you have the power to make your grid green on a local level, something that will not happen on a federal level anytime soon. So really look at what you're capable of doing on a communal level, on a smaller scale, because we can actually affect a lot of change in terms of the renewable energy. Again, and it's a lot cheaper, particularly if you look at the long-term costs that are associated with renewable energy sources compared to fossil fuels.
Just dovetailing from that, fracking is a major problem. And you mentioned, of course, Pennsylvania, you mentioned Illinois. Fracking is basically just spread wildly across the United States and across the globe. It was one of Hillary Clinton's missions at the Department of State when she was there under the Obama administration. And I mean, this is linked to contaminated water supplies. It's linked to earthquakes, all kinds of insanely destructive things. And often it happens in these poor areas or in the Rust Belt areas where people, like you said, on a local level, people can speak up. And there are some stories, of course, of people speaking out about these issues. But for many of them, they were basically steamrolled and given, you know, what to them, even if it's a few thousand dollars, is a lot of money. But for rights to do fracking and so forth, while their corporate media covers almost none of the dangers connected to fracking, even though they're well documented, even though they're well known.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is that, of course, the corporations do things like in Pennsylvania, there have been instances where there's a leak and the groundwater is poisoned. But then the company will send the landowners a letter saying, well, we'll pay for your water to be fixed, but you have to sign an agreement saying that you'll never sue us. And things like that. And they're allowed to do that, of course, because I can't remember the exact number, but even just in Pennsylvania state legislature, there's millions of dollars. I think the number was like $7 million in just 1 year that flowed into the Pennsylvania state legislature from these oil and gas companies. So the people go to their regulators and their legislators and say, hey, this is happening. What are you going to do about it? And then the legislators, of course, say, well, I guess just deal with it because this is bringing some good money into our area. You know, it's the same thing that we see happening with the Amazon thing, the horrendous display that cities across the nation went through to coax Amazon to host their second headquarters in their city, when in reality, what that would do is cause a windfall of economic downturn, because not only are you getting rid of like mom and pop shops and things like that, but you're subjecting workers to horrendous wages. The situations at Amazon packing plants are well documented as being like sweatshops. But these mayors and these officials look at this and they say, oh, I'm going to get bank if we can get Amazon headquarters to be in our city. So they wine and dine all the Amazon officials, and meanwhile, they're throwing their people into a corporate shredder.
Well, and people beg for this. Yeah, and I mean, it's like peasants begging the corporate feudal overlords to please come and throw them scraps. You know, having grown up in Western Pennsylvania and spending time in Ohio and Youngstown, Ohio, I mean, I saw the same thing there in terms of the steel mills collapsing and people begging for a private prison. This has particularly been going on the last half century. We've seen this slide, this neoliberal rightward slide, infect most of the body politic. We're seeing the results of it right now through the Obama administration, now through the Trump administration. And then Eleanor Goldfield, that leads me to the next topic, and you talked too about following the money. Let's talk a little bit about FCC Chair Ajit Pai and the plans to scrap net neutrality and what's going on with that, because that's a hot topic.
It should be a lot hotter, because everybody listening to the show could probably name in less than 10 seconds what they use the internet for on a daily basis. Very important for our movements, obviously, but it's important for staying in touch with loved ones. It's important for doing your homework or doing your job or paying bills. Like, your life now has a very large and ever-growing digital facet to it. And basically, for those who aren't that familiar, net neutrality is basically what it sounds like. It's a neutral position to the net. It basically says that neither the government nor corporations have the right to set up toll roads and slow lanes on the internet. So that means that if you wanted to visit your friend's blog, you can't be charged extra to do so. But if you kill net neutrality, that means that Verizon and Comcast and AT&T can set up these toll roads and then let their friends keep the fast lanes, and everyone else has to suffer in the slow lanes or pay more. And, of course, as the American poor continues to grow, this becomes less and less viable. And so that's why a lot of people are saying, well, it's a racial justice issue, because who are predominantly the poorest? Well, it's black and brown people. And their access to the internet has, for the first time in history, allowed them to share their stories from their own perspectives, because, again, their stories are not something that you hear on corporate media. So the effects of net neutrality and why it's necessary are so far-reaching, from racial justice to the environment to you name it. And basically what's happening is that Ajit Pai, he's a former Verizon lawyer, and so he is now the, you know, thanks to the revolving door, he's the chairman of the FCC. And he's had it out for net neutrality for quite some time. Even back in 2015, he was a commissioner then as well. He wasn't the head of the FCC, but he was on the board, and he gave speeches as to why net neutrality is a bad thing. But even back then, reports show that 85% of Republicans wanted an open, accessible net.
Exactly.
Of course, why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So this isn't a partisan issue, just like most issues. It's a corporate issue. It's a profit issue. And so what's happening, the vote is slated to happen on December 14th. And what I've been doing with the Team Internet, as we call it, is organizing not only things like calls to Congress. Congress has been getting tens of thousands of phone calls and emails a day, which is phenomenal. People basically saying, I want an open internet because this is why it's important to me. And then on the 13th, there's an overnight vigil outside the FCC here in Washington, D.C. And then early in the morning, there will be actions outside the FCC as well. And here's the thing, even if the vote happens, which we are going to try to stop it, but even if it happens, the war isn't over, but the battle is lost. And I think it's very important that people understand the weight of the battle being lost, and how, because after that, we would have to go, we would go legal routes as to say that the FCC doesn't have the right to do this. The appropriate means were not taken to set this vote and to revoke net neutrality. But legal battles, as everyone knows, are long drawn out and difficult. And it doesn't necessarily mean, just like we saw with the Dakota Access Pipeline, oil started flowing even after a judge said that Army Corps acted inappropriately. Even if we got a judge to say, yeah, this was inappropriate, the FCC revoked net neutrality, that doesn't necessarily mean that we would still have net neutrality while we're fighting this. So it's incredibly vital that people understand the weight of the situation and how important net neutrality is to our access to an open internet.
Eleanor Goldfield, that's so absolutely correct. And our friend at Electronic Frontier Foundation, Shahid Batar, has been touring around speaking about this. Craig Aaron at Free Press. Certainly you and the good work you're doing at Project Censored. We, of course, crow from the rooftops about net neutrality issues. And again, like you said, I think it's also fascinating to remember that this is not a right-left thing, a Democrat-Republican thing. It's a corporate power, greed, capitalism thing. And a vast majority of the comments going into the FCC for the last decade, anytime they hold public hearings, almost 99% of people want to keep it open, keep the net open, keep this open. And yet we still have people like Ajit Pai, who's a textbook example of regulatory capture, by the way. These people don't care. They're just going to ram it down our throats. And this is, again, really threatening to what little may be left of our democratic avenues in our society that have been vast closing in on us the past 40 years. Eleanor Goldfield, do you have a website or two that you could lead people to about the FCC issue?
The main ones is battleforthenet.com. The other one is protectourinternet.org. And those are two sites that you can go to learn more about this fight and also to join the fight. There are local chapters. You mentioned EFF. Fight for the Future is another one. There are local chapters that are fighting for this. Even like Color of Change is a racial justice mm-hmm. group that's been fighting yep. for this as well. So there are lots of different groups that are fighting for net neutrality, and it shouldn't be that difficult to find a local group to plug into.
No, and in fact, a former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, whom I always loved the quote, he did a foreword for our 2016 book. One of his books was Your Second Priority, and it talks about the importance of media freedom and media democracy. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned numerous groups that maybe their first issue is not media freedom and free press concerns. But as Nick Johnson reminds us, whatever your first area of concern is, if your second isn't based on media democracy, media freedom, access, and free press, you're likely to gain little ground in your first or primary area of interest. And again, this net neutrality case and what's happening at the FCC, this is a classic example of how people really need to get involved. Eleanor Goldfield, we only have a few minutes left in our segment here today. So I just wanted to open it up to you. And you've been giving our listeners so much to think about, and it's just a very small sampling of all the work that you do. In the last couple minutes we have, why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple other things that you're working on that you're really excited about?
One of the things that I'm very excited about is the continued work that I'm doing with my book and with spoken word and projected visuals. The collection of spoken word pieces that I originally had on ACT OUT that are now in written form. And along with that is the artwork of 15 distant artists from around the world, including the Syrian artist Tamam Azam, Anthony Freda, Abby Martin, Joe Webb, incredible visionary artists that also have responded to the responsibility call of being an artist that seeks and speaks truth and seeks and speaks what it is to be a human being at this particular place and time. That's been really exciting to work on that. Also, just continuing to work on local issues in D.C., a lot of local issues surrounding what's happening with J20. Of course, J20 was the inauguration protest that happened in January of this year, and some people are still facing 6-7 decades in jail for
yes.
protesting, or even just standing at the wrong place at the wrong time when cops kettled protesters, and I was there, and that's exactly what happened.
Including journalists.
Including journalists, absolutely. Just to give it some perspective, the average sentence for a convicted rapist is 8 years. So just to put that in perspective, these people are facing 7 decades in jail for possibly just standing on a street corner during a protest. So this is a horrific crackdown on dissent, horrific crackdown on protest. And these are things that we've seen happening. You know, like North Dakota floated a bill that would have made it legal for people to hit protesters on the street. And North Carolina floated a similar bill, which is even more terrifying when you think about what happened in Charlottesville, that could potentially be totally legal. So we're looking at a vicious crackdown on dissent, a vicious crackdown on our First Amendment and human rights. So I would definitely recommend that people stay updated on what's happening with the J20 protest, because it will affect everyone in some way. And you can find more about that at defendj20resistance.org. And they're also accepting donations. And there's a lot of work happening around this because of the implications that are seen with it. And so people should definitely stay up to date on that. And that's something that particularly local D.C. activists have been working very hard on in recent months.
Absolutely, Eleanor Goldfield. And that goes well beyond D.C. Story number 11 in our Censor 2018 book looks at law enforcement surveillance of phone records, and particularly cites the J20 case from a CityLab article about how police were confiscating protesters' phones, and even the ones that were arrested, even if they didn't have their phones with them, they were still trying to access their data and social media accounts.
Yeah.
This is just absolutely phenomenal in terms of police state in cyberspace. And again, I'm very glad that you not only are on top of that case, but you were able to share more information, more websites with our listeners of how they can get involved. And Eleanor Goldfield, artkillingapathy.com, artist, musician, poet, writer, journalist. You do so many things and wear so many hats. It's a delight to speak with you. It's an honor to have you on the Project Censored show. And we certainly look forward to collaborating and doing more with you in the future.
Thank you so much, Mickey. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all the work that you do.
We've been speaking with Eleanor Goldfield, artkillingapathy.com. Up next on the Project Censored show, I'll be joined by our own associate director, Andy Lee Roth, and we'll be talking about Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we're going to continue talking about media democracy and certainly media activism, as well as critical media literacy education. We are joined on the phone by the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy is the co-editor and contributor of 8 editions of the annual Censored Yearbooks published by 7 Stories Press. I've actually had the great pleasure of doing 6 of those with Andy as co-editors, the newest version of which is Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Just to tell you a little bit more about Andy Lee Roth, his research on topics ranging from ritual to broadcast news interviews to communities organizing for parklands has been published in such journals as the International Journal of Press and Politics, Social Studies of Science, Media Culture and Society, City and Community, and Sociological Theory. He reviews books and films for Yes Magazine, and he also is on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation, as well as an instructor in sociology at Citrus College in Southern California. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Great to join you, Mickey. Thanks so much.
Fantastic to be able to have this conversation with you on the Project Censored Show, because, again, we're both obviously biased in terms of our commitment to the mission of Project Censored and media freedom and teaching critical media literacy education. The latest book that we have is Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, and again, this is ever timely. I think all of the Censored volumes, of course, are timely. Perhaps this one, maybe more so. And perhaps you can start off with our riff. The main riff this year in the title of the book is post-truth as a theme. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
This last year, Oxford Dictionary selected that term, post-truth, as their word, their 2016 word of the year. And they identified post-truth as relating to circumstances where objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal beliefs. And with the selection of post-truth as their word of year, Oxford Dictionaries noted that there, you know, this term has been around for a decade or more, but there had been a significant spike in its use after the election of Donald Trump and also internationally after the Brexit vote. So we were thinking, obviously, about how post-truth plays out in the realm where journalism and democratic government intersect, and it made a lot of sense, I think, for this year's book.
It certainly did, and it actually is a theme that permeates several of the chapters, and it's already been a subject of the Project Censored Show here, certainly. I wanted to pick up on that. You know, Deepa Kumar, the communication scholar at Rutgers University, wrote the foreword for the Censored book this year. And she really begins, like, right out of the gate. She starts talking about what this means, this post-truth era, right? And about how there is more reliance on emotion or personal belief, things like confirmation bias, and that these provide special challenges, not just for us citizens in a purportedly free society, but also challenges for journalists and for a free press. How can the media really function this way? And by the way, that dovetails with another area of our interest, academic freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And I know Deepa touches on that in the introduction. Could you talk a little bit more about the significance of relying on empirical facts rather than emotion or confirmation bias in terms of, you know, how we go forward with our free press principles?
One way to think of that is as a series of challenges to the notion that there's a real empirical world and that journalism's job is to deal with the facts of that world. So we can go back to just after the Trump administration took power in January of this year, and we had Kellyanne Conway invoking the concept of alternative facts as an explanation for Sean Spicer's simply incorrect statement that the gathering at the inauguration had been the largest ever. We can jump forward to October of this year when the Supreme Court was hearing oral arguments on the gerrymandering case Gill versus Whitford, and some of the arguments in that case involved the use of social science evidence about the problems associated with gerrymandering, to which the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts responded, "It might be just his educational background. He was educated at Harvard," he says. But he went on to say, "But I can only describe it, this social science evidence, as sociological gobbledygook." And this elicited a response from the president of the American Sociological Association, Edward Bonilla Silva, who noted that in an era when facts are often dismissed as fake news, we're particularly concerned about a person of the Supreme Court justice's stature suggesting to the public that scientific measurement is not valid or reliable and that expertise shouldn't be trusted. And Edward Bonilla Silva's response on behalf of the American Sociological Association and sociologists more generally is, it's a tour de force in one page. But then we don't have to go back even, we can go back just less than a handful of days ago, and we had Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary for Donald Trump, explaining to journalists that the videos that Trump had retweeted, a set of three videos from the deputy leader of Britain First, which is a far-right group that expresses concern about what they call the Islamization of the United Kingdom. Trump retweeted a set of these videos, the credibility of which couldn't be documented. And when confronted on this, Sanders' answer was, whether it's a real video, the threat is real. Again, this is another variation on this theme of a post-truth era. What the press secretary or the president of the United States effectively was doing was endorsing the idea of propaganda, that fake or false information is all right and acceptable if it pursues a real and valid goal.
Well, it's another riff on alternative facts.
Right. So whether it's real video, the threat is real. The facts matter less than the point. And of course, to me, and we wrote some about this in the introduction to Censor 2018, a lot of this traces back to a 2002 exchange between Ron Susskind and what at the time was only identified as a high-level official in the George Bush administration. And Susskind reported what he heard in the exchange with this high-level official, who's now widely believed to have been Karl Rove, Bush's deputy chief of staff, who told Susskind that guys like me were in what we call the reality-based community, which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from the judicious study of discernible reality. And Susskind says, I nodded and murmured something about Enlightenment principles and empiricism. And Rove cut him off and said, that's not the way the world works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. So the roots of this notion of a post-truth society run long and deep. They certainly go back even further than the Bush administration in the United States, but they seem to have caught the public's attention in the last 12 months or so. And certainly our book is trying to draw attention to some of the problems with accepting or caving to this notion of post-truth society.
Indeed, Andy Lee Roth, we write also in the book, Nolan Higdon and I, in Post-Truth Dystopia on Fake News, Alternative Facts, and the Ongoing War on Reality. We gave a little rundown of some of these alternative facts, and the Karl Rove scenario with Susskind that you just mentioned on the reality-based community is seemingly more relevant now than ever in the so-called post-truth world. And just to remind listeners, just a quick sampling of these things included not just Sean Spicer's alternative facts about the inauguration size, but Spicer also had claimed several times that there was a terrorist attack in Atlanta, Georgia, despite the fact that it never occurred. Trump made veiled references to how Frederick Douglass was still alive, saying that he was an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more. HUD Secretary Ben Carson claimed that African-American slaves were immigrants who worked hard and found success in the United States. We could go on and on. Kellyanne Conway even went on about the fictitious massacre at Bowling Green in Kentucky. I mean, this is like an epidemic. It's really an assault on reality in many ways. And you and I kicked off the book with a quote from Rabindranath Tagore that is, in fact, one of my favorites and so apt and poignant. Tagore wrote, "The truth comes as conqueror only because we have lost the art of receiving it as guest." And that's where you kind of left off your point, is that we don't accept this post-truth reality. There is empirical evidence, and there is something called truth. Talk a little bit about that, and maybe some of the history of that as a sociologist. You've talked on some of the panels and things we've done about Max Weber and Inconvenient Facts.
Yeah, for me, going back to a lecture that Weber gave 100 years ago in November of 1917 at Munich University suddenly seemed incredibly relevant again as we heard this alternative fact distortions. And Weber, in this famous lecture that's been republished in print form now many times, Science as a Vocation is the title it's been called. But when he's talking about science, he's really talking about this idea that what does it mean to try to understand the world and to apply that knowledge to the world of politics? And the great point that Weber made that I think is relevant here is this concept of what he called inconvenient facts. He said that the main duty, the primary duty of a teacher, was to get their students to acknowledge what he called inconvenient facts, facts that are inconvenient for the students' political views. And, of course, I think that is applicable not just in classrooms and not just in the relationship between teachers and their students, but perhaps more widely, as Weber alluded to when he said, for every political position, including my own, there are inconvenient facts. And so I think a lot of what the work of Project Censors does and has been doing for 40-some years now, long before the Trump presidency or the latest kind of conflagration of public concern over the idea of so-called fake news, is to celebrate independent journalism as the purveyors of inconvenient facts about who we are as a society, what our history looks like, what are the consequences of how power is wielded in the United States and around the world. I think Weber was talking about teachers and students and politics, but I think many of us, our understanding of journalism rests on commitments that are similar to those Weber was talking about when he talked about inconvenient facts, right? When we think of journalists as watchdogs and as muckrakers, as Carl Jensen liked to use that term, Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored, when we think of journalists as watchdogs and muckrakers and of journalism as the fourth estate, we're probably harboring somewhere in our conception of what reporters do and what reporters should do, something like what Weber meant when he said that teachers should teach their students to confront inconvenient facts. Good journalists should dig for and bring to the public inconvenient stories.
Well, that's exactly what happens at Project Censored with our annual list of stories, the top 25 stories. And just to remind listeners, you're tuned in to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, and I'm speaking with the associate director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. We're talking about our newest book. It's Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. And in the first part of our conversation, we were talking about post-truths and inconvenient facts. We ended up with assessment and some analysis that Andy was giving us from sociologist Max Weber from 100 years ago on inconvenient facts. And in fact, the examples of inconvenient facts can be found in the present in a lot of the work that we've done at Project Censored, including our top 25 censored stories. Andy Lee Roth, you're also the coordinator of the Project Censored Validated Independent News Program, where we have students in classrooms at over a dozen colleges this past year with several hundred students and faculty that have been researching these stories in independent media that aren't covered in the corporate press and analyzing for their significance. Tell our listeners a little bit about the Validated Independent News process, because we have listeners here that could want to get involved with the process, since we're certainly a community-based organization that way. And then you and I can maybe talk about some examples of these inconvenient facts in the top stories.
So the process of identifying and vetting and then summarizing and publicizing these important but underreported independent news stories is really a year-round, year-long process that involves hundreds of undergraduate students at college and university campuses across the United States, up into Canada, and some years around the world. And of course, their faculty, mentors, professors who have expertise in the areas that are the subject matter of these stories. So more and more, I've come to think of what the project is doing in two ways. One is this media scholar, Yochai Benkler, coined the term networked news commons. And then the idea of a network news commons is an alternative to the old-fashioned top-down mass media model, where media was controlled by a handful of large corporations and the people who worked at those entities. And this idea of a networked news commons, it's much more horizontally organized, and it involves grassroots contributions such as those made by the students and faculty who are involved in Project Censored, very few of whom are actually professional journalists or even think of themselves in terms of being a journalist per se. So that's one view of Project Censored. The other is, as we turn to talk some about the fruits of these labors, some of the stories from the top 25, we at Project Censored have been putting together top 25 story lists since 1976. So there are now literally more than 1,000 of these crucial but underreported independent news stories, and they're all archived on our website thanks to the efforts of the students and faculty who have researched them and our fantastic webmaster, Adam Armstrong, and they're there available as a public resource. And I think it's really important, as we turn to talking about some of these individual stories, to also first orient ourselves in terms of a larger viewpoint, a bigger picture, that what you can think of these stories, this collection of stories, 1,000 some now, 25 new stories each year that we research and vet and proofread and double-check the facts on, is that Project Centered can be understood as kind of an ongoing empirical investigation of the blind spots, the third rails, the no-go zones of the U.S. corporate media. And so each story that you can look up on our website or read about in our books, or that we'll talk about a few of them here today, each story is important in its own right. But it's also important to understand each story as a data point in this larger ongoing empirical investigation of the ways in which the corporate media are failing to provide the public with the kind of news and information and perspective that we need to be informed citizens, to be engaged community members. And that theme, I think, is really important as we're all continuing to mourn the loss, the absence now of Edward S. Herman, who passed away a few weeks ago now. And Herman, of course, was, along with Noam Chomsky, the inventor of what we know as the propaganda model, published in their 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent.
Indeed, Andy Lee Roth. Why don't we talk a little bit about a few of these stories? I know you mentioned the founder of the project, Carl Jensen, earlier, who directed it for 20 years. Peter Phillips took over thereafter, and Peter has done 14 of the censored books and still teaches sociology of media, among other classes, at Sonoma State University, where the project was founded. Certainly since expanded, and Peter still helps do the research. And as you noted, we moved the project beyond and bigger for more inclusion of faculty and students to look at these stories and inconvenient facts. So why don't we look at a couple of the stories? Of course, listeners can go to projectcensored.org and look at some of the stories. But as you mentioned, Ed Herman here a moment ago, we were fortunate enough to have what appears to be the last published work of Ed Herman in the book, Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model at 30, so 30 years later. So let's take a look at some of these stories. Certainly, as far as inconvenient facts and the theme of fake news, one of the top stories this year was the Pentagon paid UK public relations firms to create fake Al-Qaeda videos.
This is a story originally reported by Crofton Black and Abigail Fielding Smith for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is a fantastic outfit out of London. And just to add one more line of credit here before we go, in terms of Project Censored and our vetting of this story, this was researched and evaluated by Matthew Misiano, who's a student at Indian River State College in Florida, and his faculty mentor, Elliot D. Cohen. So what did Crofton Black and Abigail Fielding Smith report? In October of 2016, they broke the story that the Pentagon had paid a British PR firm, Bell Pottinger, more than $660 million over a period from at least as far back as 2006 up to December of 2011 to run a top-secret propaganda program in Iraq. And Bell Pottinger's work consisted of three kinds of products, if you will: TV commercials that portrayed Al-Qaeda in a negative light, news items that were intended to look as if they'd been created by Arabic TV, so that's fake news. And then third, and maybe most sensitive, Bell Pottinger, under contract with the U.S. Department of Defense, was creating fake Al-Qaeda propaganda films. And so one of the sources that Black and Fielding Smith talked to in conducting this report, they talked with a number of former officials and contractors involved with the information operations in Iraq. One of the persons they talked to was a former video editor who reported that he was given precise instructions for the production of these fake Al-Qaeda films from very high levels in the U.S. Department of Defense. And furthermore, that U.S. Marines would take CD copies of these films on patrol to drop in the houses that they were raiding. Now, the significance of this takes this story to another level. There were codes embedded in those CDs that linked to Google Analytics accounts, which allowed then U.S. military personnel to track a list of IP addresses where the CDs had been played, and that in turn provided intelligence for U.S. operations. So one of the questions that the Bureau of Investigative Journalism report asks and answers is, why was it that the Department of Defense was using contractors, this British PR firm Bell Pottinger to do this work. And the official answer to that from their research was that the military didn't have the in-house expertise to conduct these operations. But as Black and Fielding Smith also reported, other officials, especially people formerly employed at Bell Pottinger, said that they knew that they were operating in legal gray areas. The Department of Defense knew they were operating in a legal gray area, and they wanted distance between themselves and the actual production of these videos.
This is a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, I mean, in a year where pundits and politicians from across the political spectrum, as well as members of the public and certainly journalists in the establishment press, were crowing over fake news. One of the points of this story in terms of Project Censored's coverage is that the U.S. corporate media completely ignored this story. They completely ignored how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, used taxpayer money to secretly create fake news of its own. So it's just amazing to me that this happened, but that once it happened, we're reliant on independent reporters from a British-based organization to have any knowledge of this. The reason this story ends up in the top 25 list, like all the other stories, is that as of the time of the book's publication, the Project Censored Yearbook's publication, to the best of our research abilities, these stories have not been adequately covered in the corporate press.
Indeed. And, you know, people that are familiar with the project, projectcensored.org, and know about the research and the stories that we do annually, there's a lot of heavy topics oftentimes. A lot of, like you had said, things that are going on that clearly the government and the corporate press, well, they must not want us to know about, right? And oftentimes these are stories of fraud and corruption and conflict of interest. So for some, that becomes fairly overwhelming. But it's also the case that we cover stories that look at positive or good things that are happening and civic engagement stories that are happening that the corporate press also don't cover, perhaps types of solutions journalism. And one of the stories in Censored 2018 looks at ways, tried, true, and tested ways that communities can become more involved in policing and implement policies that prevent killings by the police. That's one of the top stories this year, Andy Lee Roth.
Yeah, let me frame this story by going back to July of this year when President Trump was addressing a group of New York Police Department officers, and he asked them, please, don't be too nice. So, you know, while we have on one hand Trump ignoring all of the evidence about police violence, especially police violence that targets people of color, the flip side to that is there is signs of hope here. Our number 24 story on the 8 use of police force policies to prevent killings by police is based on research by an organization called Campaign Zero, which was formed in the aftermath of the Ferguson protests. And we have excellent reporting on the Campaign Zero study by Jamila King. So this police reform group that came into existence after Ferguson collected data using the Freedom of Information Act. They got records of police-involved killings dating back to 2015 as compiled by The Guardian and The Washington Post. And they began looking at the first wide-scale analysis to demonstrate the connection between differing use-of-force policies and the rates of police killings. And Campaign Zero identified 8 guidelines that would restrict when and how police officers could use force. And each of these 8 would greatly decrease the likelihood of civilian death. And some of these sound like common sense until you realize that these are not policies that are necessarily implemented in departments across the country. So there are things like de-escalate situations before resorting to force, restricting the use of chokeholds, giving verbal warnings before using force, prohibiting officers from shooting at moving vehicles, and requiring that any officer who is involved in the use of force in the line of duty file a comprehensive report about that incident afterwards. And what Campaign Zero found was that, on average, each additional use of force policy was associated with a 15% reduction in killings. And again, this is looking at the evidence from 90-some police departments across the country.
Well, Andy Lee Roth, this is also a story then that was contributed from a longtime supporter of the project who works with us, Ken Burrows of San Francisco State University, and his student, Malcolm Pinson, researched that story, and they actually were on the show earlier this year talking about that research. So again, it's important to notice that there are constructive and solutions-based stories that we also look at and cover in the Censored book. I'd like to remind listeners that we've been speaking with the associate director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, and Andy Lee Roth and I are co-editors of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, and that's out from Seven Stories Press. We have a foreword by Deepa Kumar, cartoons once again by Khalil Bendib, who was also on the show recently with Protop Chatterjee talking about his new book, Verax. Also in the book, by the way, more than just the top 25 stories, right, Andy? We also look at media democracy in action. We have The Trump Universe, a graphic chapter by Adam Bessy and Peter Glanting. We have a whole chapter on the new American authoritarianism and normalization of racism by Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III. Elizabeth Blakey gave us a great chapter on defamation as censorship in the social media era. We also have Breaking Through Power, a chapter by Ralph Nader, as well as Edward Herman's last contribution, Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model at 30. Andy Lee Roth, it's been a delight having you on the Project Censored show to talk about the work we do in critical media literacy education. And thanks so much for taking time out to talk about some of these very significant themes and stories with us.
Thank you, Mickey.
In that last segment, we were in conversation with Project Censored Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Earlier in the show, we were joined by Eleanor Goldfield, activist, artist, and journalist, and her website was artkillingapathy.com.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host and executive producer, Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. To learn more about Project Censored, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times where the master thief can find, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and